I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. One of the saddest movies I have ever seen is Walt Disney's Old Yeller, about the relationship between a young boy named Travis and a stray dog. Near the end of the film, Old Yeller contracts rabies after a fight with a wolf. He's locked up in a cage, develops the horrible symptoms of the disease, and then has to be shot for fear of infecting the family. Needless to say, it was heartbreaking to watch. Bill Wasik and Monica Murphy write about Old Yeller in their new book, Rabid, A Cultural History of the World's Most Diabolical Virus. They also describe the workings of the virus, strange treatments through history, its influence on pop culture, the development of the rabies vaccine, and an update on the virus today. Needless to say, we were intrigued and we asked them to join us on Radio Times. They join us from their home in California. Bill Wasik is senior editor at Wired. And Bill, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having us.
Also with us is Monica Murphy, and she holds a degree in public health and veterinary medicine. And Monica, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks so much.
Monica, let me begin with you because you are a veterinarian. Have you ever seen a case of rabies?
Not as a practicing veterinarian. We're very fortunate in this country that vaccination rates are high enough that our domestic pets don't often contract rabies, and so a veterinarian like me can be in practice for several years, see a lot of sick animals, and never see a rabid dog or cat. I did, over the course of writing the book, see my first rabid dog, but I had to travel. I went to Bali, Indonesia, and there I laid eyes on my first rabid dog.
Well, Bill, you're senior editor at Wired. What's your interest in rabies?
Well, you know, it mostly comes from living with Monica, you know, who would come home, you know, even though she didn't see rabies cases as a practicing veterinarian, she would come home and tell me lots of just amazing facts about rabies. And I started to think about the kind of cultural implications of rabies, you know, both just the sort of word rabid, which we use in all of these sort of very different and sort of inappropriate contexts if you think about rabies as a sort of tragic and fatal disease, and yet we'll talk about, you know, rabid enthusiasms or rabid hatreds. And so I started to think about the cultural implications, and so, you know, realized that between, you know, Monica's interest in the science and my interest in the history and the culture of it, that there was a really fun book idea, something that we could do together.
Well, I have to say, and as I said in my intro, your book, Bill, took me back to a traumatic movie experience in my childhood. Have you seen Old Yeller?
I have. Yeah, some people have said that the ending of Old Yeller is tantamount to child abuse.
Well, it certainly was. I remember just crying for days. But Monica, you also say in the book that under today's understanding of rabies, Old Yeller might have been treated differently.
In that Old Yeller would have hopefully been vaccinated in advance of any exposure via the wolf, certainly. We are very good at getting the message out to people that their dogs and cats need to be vaccinated. In your neck of the woods in New Jersey, I think it was just this week or last that there was an attack of a rabid animal on a backyard dog in Cherry Hill, and the dog was vaccinated, so the dog's okay. The dog got a booster vaccine and is quarantined for a few days, but nothing bad is going to happen to that dog.
Monica, why is this virus so very virulent?
Well, it's the virus is really good at getting inside the nervous system and attacking the parts of the brain that will ultimately promote its spread. The virus climbs up the nervous system and acts on the limbic system, which is a primitive part of the brain. It controls rage and terror, desires, and by acting there, it really distorts the behavior of the victim and ultimately, before it shuts down the brain entirely, leading to cessation of the vital functions, it really transforms the victim into a real brutish, furious animal, and it's a pretty ugly way to go.
It's a bullet-shaped virus. Why is that significant?
Well, I mean, to us it was significant metaphorically. I don't know in what way the shape of the virus affects its ability to act on the body, but the virus is really special in the way it does create infection by entering at a bite wound site, attaching to a local nerve cell there, and then climbing slowly up the nervous system into the brain. And this is distinct from what happens with most other viruses, where the virus enters the body and then gets into the bloodstream and spreads around to find its way to the target tissues. The rabies virus is pretty nasty in that it goes right away for its target system and then has a gradual climb to reach its goal.
Well, I have to say, and I'll go back to you, Bill, your description in the book about how this virus works, it seemed like a treatment for a horror flick or a horror movie.
Well, yeah, and there's a way in which, you know, rabies is sort of our original horror tale. I mean, you think about, you know, the vampire myth and the werewolf myth, the zombie myth. These are all, at least the way that we depict them today, these are all saliva-borne infections. You know, they all have this sort of rabid-type approach. And to my mind, it's, you know, rabies has always been feared far above its, you know, the number of people that it actually kills. And to my mind, part of that is, as Monica said, it's a terrible way to go. You know, it's a nearly 100% fatal infection once it actually infects the brain. It's the highest death rate, the highest case fatality rate of any disease. But I also think part of it is the sort of the animal nature of the infection makes it especially terrifying. Sort of the idea that, you know, there's this furious creature, you know, whether it's a dog or a fox or whatever, and it bites you and it sort of transfers to you this kind of fatal animal madness. And so, yeah, I mean, rabies on some level is a kind of, it's a sort of original horror tale.
Well, it sounds like the way we think about zombies and vampires, Bill.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, what's interesting is that the vampire myth and the zombie myth, in their origins, were both a bit different from how they are today. I mean, on some level, they were a little less rabid in that, you know, they were sort of dead people come back to life, but their condition wasn't necessarily contagious. I mean, it wasn't necessarily spread through bites. But in the 19th century, the sort of English vampire fiction tradition begins to spread up, and around the middle of the 19th century, you start to see the outlines of the vampire myth as we have it today, you know, where it's this, the vampire has animal-like fangs, and he bites you, and his biting spreads the condition, so you yourself become a vampire. And a similar transformation happened with the zombie myth, you know, as it came out of Haiti. So today we have these creatures, especially, you know, in contemporary film, that are very, very rabid. And in fact, 28 Days Later, the zombie film, the director, Danny Boyle, actually said that he based the virus, the kind of zombie virus, on rabies. And what he loved about the sort of rabies was this, the idea that it was a disease of aggression that was also a disease of fear. And there, again, is sort of a really interesting horror film trope.
A perfect combination. Monica, let me go back to you, and even going back to the symptoms that human beings experience if they have rabies. And again, this is frightening to think about. They have a thirst, but they can't seem to swallow. Can you expand on that?
Sure. That symptom is called hydrophobia. And historically, it's been so closely associated with rabies that human rabies was called hydrophobia for a long, long time. What hydrophobia is a revulsion to water, and it starts with an inability to swallow. Well, the muscles that control swallowing are affected by the infection in the brain, so that it's difficult to get liquids or solids down. But liquids especially provoke a feeling of panic when it's difficult to swallow them. So the patient, after being affected by this condition for some hours, may become so panicked at the sight of water offered to them that they feel uncontrollable terror. And it's a horrible thing to witness. Your listeners should definitely not go on YouTube and look for videos of this symptom.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, it's really gruesome and so sad because like a lot of sick people, the rabid patient is likely to be thirsty, in need of fluids, but really can't take a drink.
Well, and it sounds like even from the way you describe it in the book is for an individual, they kind of vacillate between what seems like madness and a kind of lucidity.
Yeah, I think those periods of lucidity are probably the worst thing about the disease. The fact that the rabies patient has time to contemplate just how awful the situation is and how grim the likely outcome, it's pretty cruel.
Well, we should say we're talking about something very rare when it comes to humans and probably to domesticated animals as well. But Monica, if I can go back to you, also symptoms of hypersexuality. Help us understand that.
Well, it's actually a pretty unusual symptom of rabies. It happens in just a small minority of the patients affected by rabies, but it does capture the imagination. Certainly, we found it impossible not to bring up in the book, and many of our readers have asked us about it because it is kind of adds to the terror of the whole spectrum of signs. The victim may be involuntarily aroused and really experience a lot of sexual feeling during the end stages of the disease, and
wow.
It's definitely something that. And Bill can speak to this better, but historically has affected the way people see rabies.
You want to speak to that? And we should just, so our listeners know what we're talking, I mean, as you describe it, people having just multiple orgasms, for instance. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, yeah, and there are records in you know, the literature going back to, you know, Galen, sort of early physician in the Greco-Roman tradition, of people having, you know, involuntary orgasms, you know, 30 in 24 hours and
wow.
that sort of thing. And it's something that you will see in case reports in the present day as well. Partly you see this coming up, as you might imagine, in the Victorian era, where there was this sort of outsized terror of rabies, just the idea of rabies as this sort of disease, not just of animal aggression, but also of this kind of animal sexuality. And in fact, there was a theory that was actually very widespread among veterinarians that the dog rabies actually would generate spontaneously in dogs that were not allowed to mate. This was actually a dominant theory of how canine rabies happened, was that because you have the beginning of this pet keeping tradition in, you know, London and Paris and these other cities where there was this sense among certain people that there was this unnatural keeping of animals, you know, in houses and treating them, you know, like people, and not allowing them to gratify their animal urges, and that
well, you know what, Bill, hold on to that thought, only because we're up on a very short break. We're talking about rabies today on Radio Time. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Arcadia University supports WHYY and supports great teachers and education leaders. The Department of Labor projects an increased need for education administrators in the next decade. Arcadia's doctoral and master's programs in educational leadership are designed to help prepare you for the future. Arcadia's educational leadership master's and doctoral programs are dedicated to great learning, great leaders, and greater lives. Online registration today. Classes begin August 29th. arcadia.edu/greatteachers.
Next time in Studio 360, the best DJ in the world?
I was against the very straightforward music scene there where it was like one style of music all night long. I had these greater ideas and trying to draw linkages between these different types of music and really push it.
A lesson from a world-class DJ. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
A new school year is just starting. Parents are busy with back-to-school shopping for supplies and clothes. But for some families, this time means more than getting the right markers, notebooks, and folders. We'll talk with the parents of special needs children about how they prepare for the beginning of the year. That's next time on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Viviana Hurtado.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We're not trying to scare you, but we're talking with Bill Wasik and Monica Murphy about rabies, the subject of their new book called Rabid. It's about the science, the history, and mythology of the disease. More than 100 years ago, Louis Pasteur developed a rabies vaccine, and centuries before him, Pliny the Elder recommended applying the burnt hair of a dog to the infected wound. He had other treatments as well. And Wasik, a senior editor at Wired, and Murphy is a veterinarian, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Bill, I had to jump on you because we were up on a break there. You were talking about the 19th century and dogs.
Well, yeah, there was this very strange theory that developed among veterinarians that that rabies actually would develop spontaneously in dogs that weren't allowed to mate. And so, you know, you have rabies kind of as this disease, not just of animal aggression, but of this kind of animalistic sexuality. And this was a something that was really believed right up until the point that Louis Pasteur, with his rabies vaccine, sort of established, you know, once and for all, you know, the germ theory, and that that rabies was in fact a virus that could be, you know, that it was a entirely contagious, not just in dogs, not just in people, but in dogs.
Well, let me go back to you, Monica. I'm picking up on Louis Pasteur developing the rabies vaccine. I would say, as you describe, at some great risk to himself and his assistants.
Yes, indeed. Well, you know, rabies, unlike other organisms that had been studied in the Pasteur laboratory, rabies is a virus and can't be grown, or with the technology of the day, couldn't be grown on a plate or in a tube. In order to study rabies, you had to keep the virus going in live animals. So they had a laboratory full of rabid animals, mm-hmm. and they had to go through great derring do to extract the infectious principle from the affected animals, and that involved putting a rabid dog on the table and extracting drops of rabid saliva through a mouse pipette using, you know, mouth suction.
Wow.
And pretty scary stuff. The efforts paid off, certainly, but there was a definite feeling that it was life or death there in the laboratory.
And would it be fair to say that was the first modern vaccine? I know Jenner had done some work with smallpox, but...
Right. Well, Jenner certainly had a big breakthrough with smallpox, but in some sense, it was something he happened upon. I mean, he sort of developed an awareness that... people who were naturally infected with the strain that we now call cowpox had immunity to smallpox, and so were really able to survive smallpox much better than the unexposed population. And he figured out a way to apply this broadly to sort of purposefully infect people with cowpox so that they were protected from smallpox. But what Pasteur did was really a big leap forward from that. He really was a big believer in the germ theory, and in fact, his work is more than anyone else's, perhaps except for Koch, cemented the germ theory in the scientific mind of the 19th century. He believed that for every contagious illness, there was an infectious agent behind it, and that that infectious agent could be manipulated in the laboratory in such a way as to create a weaker strain that could be given to people to induce immunity.
Wow.
And he started with animal illnesses. He did anthrax vaccine and chicken cholera vaccine, and these were successful. He wanted to debut his methodology in a human disease that would capture public attention, that would really, in the public mind, create, you know, extreme certainty that Pasteur was right about all this infectious principle stuff. And he chose rabies largely because it would be such a spectacle for everyone around the world to become aware of his vaccine methodology through a disease that, even while it's always had a pretty low death rate in a population, it's always had people's imagination. It's always made headlines when it occurs.
What's interesting, so, Bill, is after, as he's developing this vaccine, a anti-vaccine movement develops as well.
No, that's right. And it's funny to see the way in which, you know, some of the misinformation that we have about vaccines today, you know, it really has a kind of intellectual beginning, you know, at the very in, invention of vaccines. You know, the sense that there was something, I think, unnatural about what Pasteur was doing really sort of stuck with people, even as, you know, what Pasteur really was creating was arguably mankind's greatest invention ever.
Well, going back centuries before that, Bill, even to Pliny the Elder, and I have to say his remedies are so wonderfully exacting. I wonder if you could describe some of them for our listeners.
Sure. Well, you know, yeah, Pliny the Elder is a, you know, was a sort of natural, he wrote a natural history, and he kind of assembled this incredible collection of rabies treatments and rabies cures. The one that's best known is to take a hair from the dog that bit you and to burn it and to put the ashes into the wound. And this is the treatment from which we get our sort of hangover remedy, you know, the hair of the dog.
Exactly.
And that expression comes from this sort of daffy idea that Pliny the Elder passes along. But, you know, he just has this incredible laundry list of things, a lot of them involving animals. You know, take this part of the rooster and burn it and make a poultice out of it, or you know, the ashes from the tail of a shrew mouse. I mean, it really reads like a witch's, you know, like a witch's spell book or something. And what's remarkable is that until Pasteur, you know, the question of how to treat rabies was essentially, you know, the very same amount of misinformation sort of persisted throughout history, just because there was no treatment for rabies. You know, the one thing that did make a difference was you could cauterize the wound, which is, you know, essentially the sort of very, very painful process of taking something hot, like a hot piece of metal, and burning the place where the animal bit you. That was a common recommendation, and that would actually have helped in that if you can sort of stop the virus from getting into the nerves at the site of the wound, or if you can stop it from climbing up into the nervous system, that you can help to arrest the spread of the disease. But other than that, there was pretty much nothing to do. And so on some level, you sort of have to feel for all of these ancient doctors that were trying to come up with remedies, because, you know, there, until the vaccine, there wasn't really anything that worked.
And that's Bill Wasik, who joins us along with Monica Murphy. I should say they are married to each other, and they have co-authored a new book called Rabid, A Cultural History of the World's Most Diabolical Virus. Bill is senior editor at Wired, and Monica Murphy holds a degree in public health and veterinary medicine. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Anything you ever wanted to know about rabies, give us a call. Let's get Phil from Doylestown to join our conversation. And, Phil, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Yeah, I was bitten by a baby bat one time, and it was just such a tiny bite. I thought, wonder if I should go and get rabies shots or not. And finally, I read the symptoms and said, once you get the symptoms, you're pretty much dead. So off I went to the emergency room, and my insurance charges $100 per visit, and it's the only place you can get shots. You can't get them at the doctor's office because it's such a delicate type of vaccine that I had to go 5 times. And I said, geez, couldn't you send it to the regular doctor so I don't have to pay the $100 emergency fee? And they said, well, if you went to a regular doctor and didn't have insurance, this would cost you about $10,000 for these vaccines. And I realized, gosh, if I didn't have health insurance, would I be willing to take the risk of paying $10,000 if I didn't have much money, or say maybe I won't get rabies from the shots? And it was, you know, quite a conflict there to think about.
All right. Well, I appreciate the call, Phil, and I'm glad you're okay. Monica, let me just pick up on a couple of things that Phil said. And he said he was bitten by a baby bat. You write about bats in this book.
Mm-hmm. Bats are, in North America, the most important rabies vector in that the few cases in humans that have occurred over the last few decades are almost exclusively attributed to bat bites when they're of domestic origin. So while we have other wildlife vectors of rabies in this country, like foxes, raccoons, skunks, bats are tricky because those bites can be real subtle, and people don't always have the instinct to follow up with inconvenient and sometimes expensive rabies vaccine series after exposure to a bat.
But the vaccines work, yes?
vaccines work great. No vaccine is perfect, of course, but the rabies vaccine is wildly successful vaccine. It's a real lifesaver. And so definitely an important follow-up step if you are exposed to a bat or another rabid animal in this country. We're mostly talking about wildlife. But if you travel, the dog remains the most important vector worldwide.
In fact, I was reading a piece in the New York Times in the last couple of weeks about stray dogs in India.
Yes.
And the fact that something like 20,000 people in that country die of rabies.
Yeah, rabies is an important disease in India. Of course, it's in the mix with a lot of other important diseases in India, so it persists. The will isn't there to do widespread canine vaccination that would really shut it down. But I thought that article in the New York Times was interesting because it fell prey to a lot of the same ways of thinking that keep rabies going in developing countries around the world. You know, the article suggested that by reducing stray populations, we'd be able to reduce the incidence of rabies in places like India. And while, you know, there's something to that, it's not the most important way to reduce rabies infections in areas where canine rabies is still really prevalent. The most important step is vaccination. By creating a population of immune dogs that surround our communities, we're able to keep rabies away from our families. And so by reducing dog numbers, you do create an open niche that then more dogs are going to come into. If they're not vaccinated, you're just as vulnerable as you were before you eliminated or removed the dogs. And so only by basing your strategy on vaccination and really increasing the number of vaccinated dogs around your community, are you going to reduce the rabies incidence in people?
Let me get Rivka from Westmount Airy to join our conversation. And Rivka, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I've been listening to your conversation, and I'm very grateful for it, but I have a concern that by the emphasis on domestic vaccinating the domestic population, people become somewhat unconcerned and uninformed about rabies in wild animals. And I have a friend who I live in Westmount area, and I have a friend who several years ago was bit by a presumably rabid dog when walking in the woods. And then this spring, I saw a raccoon who was looking very mangy and acting very strangely at 10 o'clock in the morning and reported it. It turned out that it was rabid, but this was only established after it had, in fact, attacked someone.
Oh, wow.
So I think people should, you know, be informed, and maybe you can help with that, about what to watch for in a wild animal that would be a sign that you want to be tremendously careful around it.
That's a good point, Rivka. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Bill, do you want to take that first?
Well, Monica, why don't you...
Go ahead, Monica.
Sorry.
Trying to share things here. Go ahead, Monica.
Yeah. Absolutely. Rabies is, in this country, it's a wildlife disease, and we should be very cautious around wildlife that we're seeing at an unusual time of day, whose behavior is deranged, is not grooming itself, or, you know, whose behavior is otherwise inexplicable. But I do think it's a testament to the fact that people do know to seek treatment when they're bitten by a wild animal, that we haven't seen raccoon rabies in any significant numbers in people, even as an epizootic of rabies has raged up and down the East Coast affecting raccoons. Many, many people who live on the East Coast have seen a suspect rabid raccoon in their lifetimes, but most of us know that if a raccoon, you know, jumps off the trash can onto our shoulder, we should go to the emergency room for that. It's tricky in countries where dog rabies is still prevalent, and it's tricky in this country when a dog or a cat gets infected by a wild animal, because our dogs and cats live very, very closely with us, and sometimes they bite us. We can sort of attribute good reasons for it. Oh, he was defending the food, or, right. You know, oh, we were sort of in
wrestling.
His... territory, and so we might not seek follow-up care, might not recognize that as a very dangerous situation the same way we would if, you know, a coyote, you know, latches onto our ankle during our morning jog. So I think it is a reasonable distinction to make, because the places where rabies kills the most people are the places where the domestic animals don't have good protection against rabies, and people are exposed through those animals, the ones that live at our feet, more than the ones that come out of the woods.
Rivka, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We're jumping all over history, but Bill, let me toss this to you. Interesting section in the book about the Inquisition and a mysterious brotherhood of healers that would roam from town to town, as you write, offering protection against rabies. Who were these healers?
Well, they were called Salutadores, and they were these sort of informal faith healers that would roam from town to town. And, you know, the rabies wasn't the only disease that they would offer to treat, but it was the sort of the thing that they were famed for. And part of what's interesting here is that, well, there are a couple things. The first is that we often tend to think of the Inquisition, you know, the time of the Spanish Inquisition, as this sort of totalitarian regime where, you know, nobody was allowed to believe anything other than what was, you know, written down by the church. But in practice, of course, you had this real riot of different beliefs and, you know, this sense that, that rabies was this, you know, then as sort of as forever, rabies was this kind of special terror and the, but also rabies as this sort of demonic force. You know, the part of what makes, the Salutadores really interesting to me is that they were also known as witch hunters. So they were famed for being healers of rabies, but they were also people who would actually be brought in sometimes by the authorities to try to find witches in various towns. And so, you know, it sort of helps in my mind to cement this idea of rabies as this form of possession, which is something that you really see a lot of times coming out of, you know, the sort of early Christian context where rabies is, you know, it is seen as this sort of demonic spirit that enters people. And the idea of these holy, you know, medieval healers sort of has the same kind of resonance to it.
And about a minute before a second break here, Bill, but just picking up on that, also the idea that this this would be transmitted from an animal to a human, just kind of underscoring the horror.
Yeah, it's funny because you know, if you look at the pre-Christian tradition, a lot of times dogs had this very sort of hallowed place in the order of things. But then if you look at the Bible, the mentions of dogs are all very, very negative. And so there's this interesting transformation that happens with rabies also, where it becomes less like a sort of part of the order of things and more like this kind of foreign, you know, satanic spirit.
And that's Bill Wasik, who joins us along with Monica Murphy. We are talking about rabies today on Radio Times. They've co-authored a new book called Rabid, and it's subtitled A Cultural History of the World's Most Diabolical Virus. Monica Murphy holds degrees in public health, also in veterinary medicine. Bill Wasik, senior editor at Wired. We've got a lot of callers that want to join our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Where you go to know what's happening in the arts. From paintings to plays to pastries, Friday Arts celebrates local cultural expression October 5th, where you go to know tomorrow's greats today. Starting October 14th, On Stage at Curtis showcases powerful performers and captivating concerts. Where you go to know what inspires talented musicians. On Canvas features legends and up-and-comers, on stage and behind the curtain, starting October 18th. The new fall season on WHYY, where you go to know.
On the next Fresh Air, the secret tactics used by the FBI and then-California Governor Ronald Reagan to stop Berkeley's radical student movement in the 60s. We talk with Seth Rosenfeld about the information he uncovered through the Freedom of Information Act after four lawsuits. His new book is called Subversives. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A former skinhead who now preaches love says hate groups are laying low after the Sikh temple shooting, but they will be back. Also, what happens when all the women in a small town in South Carolina get up and leave? All of them, 8 to 82. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Pretty rare to have an encounter with a rabid animal if you live in the United States. Nonetheless, it's a fascinating virus with a fascinating history. And our guests, Bill Wasik and Monica Murphy, write about rabies in a new book called Rabid, A Cultural History of the World's Most Diabolical Virus. Let me get, looks like Keith from Princeton to join us. And Keith, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm actually in the field of public health with the Princeton Health Department.
Oh,
so this is a very interesting discussion for me. I wonder if either of the guests can comment on a case of rabies that occurred many years ago where a gentleman had get bitten by a rabid animal, apparently went to Mexico and then returned to the United States and had not showed any signs or symptoms for about 7 years from the initial bite. And I know that's very uncommon. I think it's a very poorly documented case, but apparently that did occur, and it was one of the few cases that occurred where it took that long for signs and symptoms to show. And I will take my answer off the air.
Keith, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Monica, I'm going to toss that to you.
Yeah, he's an outlier. It's true. There are a few pretty reliable case reports of people not manifesting signs of rabies until several years after exposure. I have one coming to mind, the details of which I can't remember, but it was, I think, a child who emigrated from the Philippines, where they have dog rabies, to Australia or New Zealand, where they don't. And the child did come down with rabies and died, and there was no way to explain that exposure other than going back several years to when the child had still lived in the Philippines. Hmm. And so, yeah, those things are possible. The more typical, though, is a time lapse of weeks to months between the bite and the signs of rabies developing. And for us, that creates an opportunity to give vaccine between exposure and when someone comes down with clinical rabies. For historically, before the vaccine, though, that was just a poorly defined period of terror. If you were bitten by a suspect animal and you had no vaccine, I guess this is still true for people in some parts of the developing world, no vaccine is available. You had to wait and hope you didn't get rabies, and you didn't know you were in the clear for many months or years, because there are reports floating around of people getting rabies years after the bite exposure, and that's scary stuff.
Well, you also write about some cases of people that have actually survived rabies. Bill, can I toss that to you?
Sure. There had been no documented case of anyone surviving rabies without any vaccine until 2004, where there was this very dramatic case of a girl in Wisconsin who was taken to a children's hospital in Milwaukee. And the doctor there had never seen a case of rabies before, like most American physicians, but he did some very quick research and decided that he was going to try this novel treatment, which is essentially to induce a medical coma in the girl. And he, you know, she was in the coma for about a week, and he brought her out, and she survived. And so it was this remarkable case. And since then, a number of cases around the country have been treated with this thing that's now called the Milwaukee Protocol, and it's this kind of refined version of this original idea that this doctor tried. Only a handful of people have survived. The majority of people who have been treated with the protocol haven't survived. And in fact, there's still an active controversy among rabies experts, even though, some people have survived after receiving this treatment. There is still an active controversy about whether this really is a good way to treat rabies patients.
Let me get Lisa from Marion to join us. Lisa, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I have an interesting question about the propagation of the virus. It seems to me that once the host dies, the virus's chance for replicating itself are finished, which means to me that the fact that it crawls up the system into the brain and attacks the rage center, which makes biting more likely, allows the virus to infect another host before its current host dies.
A very wily virus you're describing, Lisa. Let me see what Monica Murphy says. Monica, is she on to something?
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things that fascinated us about rabies and got us thinking about writing about it. You know, there are other parasites that do just that, derange the behavior of the host in such a way as to promote their own spread. But rabies, you know, stands out as a virus that can do that, and a virus that can do that to people specifically. The rabies virus absolutely seems to be strategic in the way it causes a host to be angry and fearful and bitey, if you're a bitey species. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, the virus replicates in the saliva, guaranteeing that should a bite occur, that bite is likely to be laced with lots and lots of virus that can make its way up the nerves of the victim of the bite.
Are there connections between rabies and, let's say, SARS or Ebola, viruses like that?
Well, they're not related viruses, and, you know, it would be a little more abstract to argue that those viruses are affecting the behavior of their host in such a way to promote their own spread. I leave that to the HIV and SARS scientists to think about. But rabies virus is similar to those viruses in that it comes from animals, and that's something we discuss in the book. Is just that there are many important deadly viruses of humans that come from animal populations, but rabies is the one that historically has been best understood because it's such a visible transference of infection from animal to people, and really occurs in such a outrageous way that even ancient man could sort out what was happening there.
You mentioned Bali, and there was a site of a rabies. I don't know if epidemic is too strong a word, but certainly the appearance of rabies there. Do you want to take that, Bill, or you, Monica, and then we'll get back to our callers.
Monica, one.
Go ahead, Monica.
I better take that.
Okay.
In Bali was a rabies-free island up through 2008, and so while other islands in Indonesia had rabies by this time, Bali had never had a case. What seems to have happened is one dog made it into the country with an active rabies infection, or perhaps it was during its latency phase. But the one dog that came to the island and had signs of rabies and started biting people and other animals was able to affect an epizootic of rabies among the dogs there, such that many, many dogs eventually got rabies as it's spread slowly across the island, and tragically, many people died of rabies over the next couple of years. I think when I was in Bali back in fall of 2010, about 2 years into the outbreak, there had been 100 deaths, and most of them were children.
Wow, and how about today?
Well, they have affected a vaccine campaign in the dogs of Bali that has shown great success. It's not... The success is not complete yet. They haven't wiped rabies from the face of Bali, and I hope they will. But they, relying on the principle that if you get a 70% vaccination rate, if 70% of the dogs are immune to rabies, then you can shut down the spread of rabies in a population. They went house to house, village to village, and vaccinated all the dogs they could find against rabies. And immediately, the numbers of new cases started going down. Mm-hmm. And so... There have been a trickle of rabies cases since the island-wide vaccine campaign went into effect, but it's done a great job of breaking that cycle of infection.
Let me get Betsy from Bethlehem to join us on Radio Times. Betsy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi.
I have a 14-year-old border collie who's due for his vaccine. He doesn't get around very well. He has definitely shown signs of aging. And I was wondering, is it really necessary for me to put him through another shot?
Betsy, first of all, you should talk to your vet about that, okay?
Okay, I have talked to my vet, and I have several vets. I never have the same one. And one says they don't think so, and the other one says yes.
Okay. Well, I'll put this to you, Monica, knowing, of course, that you don't know Betsy or her dog, but go ahead.
Right. Yeah. I don't mind saying yes. I think you should vaccinate your dog against rabies. We have a geriatric dog ourselves, me and Bill, and she gets vaccinated against rabies. I believe in Pennsylvania, where I used to practice, it's a once every 3 year vaccine for an older dog, and it'll give you peace of mind. It protects not only your dog but your family from rabies. And a lot of people don't realize that even if your dog is not likely to encounter other wildlife vectors, bats live amongst us, and sometimes when they get sick, even show up in our homes. Hmm. So it's good to know your dog is protected and know that your family is protected from weird situations like that.
Betsy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Bill, let me go to you. And again, I'm going to quote from your book. You write, the 19th century was indeed the best and the worst of times for the Western dog. You referenced this earlier, but I'd like to just have you expand on that a bit.
Well, sure. I mean, it's this fascinating time where you have the rise of a kind of culture of pet keeping, especially among the middle and upper middle class. You know, if you sort of going back, if you go back, you know, even just 100 years, there's sort of the perception of dogs as a working animal. You know, I mean, we still often think of the farm dog as a working animal, but then when you have this sort of mass urbanization, people begin to keep dogs as pets. And so you have this culture of pet pampering that begins for the first time. You also have the beginnings of things like dog shows, you know, a lot of fancy breed dogs begin to develop at this time. But then on the other hand, with urbanization, you also have very, very efficient transfer of rabies. And so you will have these, you know, mass hysterias as, you know, rabies spreads among street dogs and then in turn, you know, affects people's own dogs, and then people get bit by their dogs and people die of rabies. And that in turn leads to, you know, literally dog massacres that happen periodically in cities where people just, you know, just like today, they get fed up with rabies. They believe that, you know, they believe that the street dogs have rabies and that their own dogs don't have rabies, and so they will carry out these campaigns or would carry out these campaigns to kill dogs. And so yeah, I mean, that's sort of the best and worst of times. You know, dogs begin to become part of the family, sort of like they are today, and yet with the urbanization and this terror of rabies, you occasionally have dogs treated, you know, very, very cruelly.
Indeed. Let me get, looks like Terry from Pennington to join us on Radio Times. And Terry, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
This is a really interesting conversation.
Thank you.
My question regards a study abroad program that my son did his junior year. They visited Africa, India, and several Asian countries. And they were required, all of the kids were required to get, I don't remember, 5 or 6 different vaccinations. They were not required to get the rabies vaccine, but it was suggested, recommended, but not required. And when he went to get it, he found that it was like $800 or $900, something like that. It was very expensive. And we considered it and thought, well, if it was really important, they would have required it. And so we ended up not doing it. And I'm just wondering if, you know, was that the, he's fine. He's back. He's
good.
Been fine. Nothing
good.
Happened. But for other people, I wonder, should it be required, and why is it so expensive?
Yeah, and Terry, you're the second person to raise the issue of cost, and Monica, as a veterinarian, do you have an answer to that?
I can't really speak to why it's so expensive. It's because it's not so commonly used in this country. I think it costs a lot for the institutions that do dispense it to keep fresh supplies in stock. Compared to other vaccines, but I really can't provide any more detail than that. And, of course, it's a human travel doctor who is best able to comment on, you know, whether a rabies vaccine is required for a specific given trip. But I will say that, you know, sometimes travel doctors will send us into rabies endemic areas without a vaccine recommendation, and that's because we are able to do post-exposure treatment. So in a situation where you are going to maybe go somewhere where there are lots of rabid dogs, but you'll be near a good hospital or near an airport, you can get bitten by a rabid dog and still be pretty safe from rabies infection by virtue of the fact that the vaccine can be given after exposure, unlike some of those other diseases that they will insist you be vaccinated against before heading out on your trip.
Terry, thanks for the call. Let's squeeze John from Coopersburg on Radio Times. John, go ahead.
Hi, I have a question about animal control officers not appearing to be interested in tracking possible rabies. I've had a couple of occasions where I've had a woodchuck or a raccoon that appeared to be rabid in my yard, called the animal control officer, and they said, no, we're not going to test it, dispose of it any way you want. And I wondered if your guest thought that was appropriate.
Well, that's a good question. Monica, we're back to you.
Well, the way rabies cases are handled in wildlife varies a lot from locality to locality. In many areas of this country, rabies is pretty endemic. So in any given season, summer season, there are going to be, you know, many rabid critters, you know, roaming around a municipality. And in the absence of an exposure of a human being or a domestic animal, they may not want to spend the resources on testing the animal, the wildlife that's stumbling around your yard. You know, in some parts of the country where rabies is not as common, that might not be true, or in areas where they, I guess, have resources to spare, maybe they want to know every last rabid raccoon in their district. But, you know, I think that that even though there are variations in the way rabid wildlife cases are handled around the country, there's overall a really good job is being done at protecting humans from rabies by virtue of the fact that we don't see human rabies cases in this country attributable to rabid raccoons or rabid skunks or rabid foxes. They're virtually non-existent.
John, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Monica Murphy, Bill Wasik, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. The book is called Rabid, A Cultural History of the World's Most Diabolical Virus. Monica Murphy holds degrees in public health and veterinary medicine. Bill Wasik, senior editor at Wired. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. Fred Snyder, the engineer for today's edition of the show, is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.